scripture reading this morning will be from 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 19 through 28. This woman's son died in the night because she lay on it. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead son in my bosom. When I arose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, he was not my son, whom I had borne. Then the other woman said, No, for the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. But the first woman said, No, for the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. Then the king said, The one says, This is my son who is living, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, No, for your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one. The king said, Get me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king. The king said, Divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other. Then the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, Oh, my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him. But the other said, He shall be neither mine nor yours, divide him. Then the king said, Give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him. She is his mother. When all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice.
This morning we're going to be looking at this account that we find in the Old Testament scriptures about King Solomon. The title of the lesson is Natural Affection, and I'll talk some about what we glean from this story and this account, and then build on that for some other applications for us to look at and to think about and to consider. It's an interesting story. It's one that we kind of sit back and are amazed at, and that's exactly the point of it. As you start looking at this, we begin to see some things that, as we reflect upon how this came about and the judgment that was rendered, you know, we can't help but marvel at that whole process that unfolded on this occasion. Let me notice some things to talk about this natural affection. The example of the judicial wisdom of Solomon is evidenced here. And notice I put judicial wisdom, and that's deliberate. There's some elements to that. There's facets as you start looking at what the nature of the wisdom that Solomon had. Solomon's a very wise individual. You go back to 1 Kings 3, 5 through 13, which just precedes the reading that we noted. And this was the time and occasion when God in a dream appeared to Solomon and gave him the opportunity to request anything his heart desired. Solomon, being a young individual, as he has now ascended onto the throne of his father, King David, felt this great urgency and need to be able to do rightly by the nation, to fulfill his role as a king. It demonstrated a good deal of insightfulness on his part, didn't it? Just to even be aware that this was a situation that was going to be a challenge for him. So he asked of God to give him wisdom so that he could judge the people, the nation, correctly and rightly. God said, because you asked that, I'll give you not only that, but I'm also going to give you peace among those around about you. There won't be warring. You won't have problems associated with that among other nations. Certainly think about David and all the wars and the fighting that was involved in him, both prior to his becoming king and during the time he was king. Solomon's reign didn't have those things. And he would also give him great riches. And certainly we read about that, the riches of Solomon, what all he had. And of course, a lot of things that Solomon did and the ability to accomplish so many things in his life, both because of the peace and God giving him those things that he needed to be able to focus attention upon building up the nation. And now you look then at the 10th chapter in verses 1 through 9. I do that as we go further into the account of the events of Solomon's life, because you have the Queen of Sheba showing up on the scene. She's traveled a great distance. Again, a familiar account to us for the most part. We have some acquaintance with that. We see that she comes there in the presence of Solomon. She's heard so many things about this king. She wants to go and see these things for herself. She brings gifts, and of course, it's reciprocated. Solomon's going to give her things in return. But she comes, and she's there for this period of time, and she's observing all the things going on. And she marvels at the wisdom of Solomon, his abilities, and what he's been able to accomplish. And she says the half was not told, which again itself is kind of intriguing, because you think about it, if you hear a great deal about something, it's not uncommon that you go and you're somewhat disappointed. Your expectations are so high that you go get there and it just doesn't measure up to what you anticipated, right? That's not an uncommon circumstance that we experience in life. And yet, what does the Queen of Sheba do? She gets there, she says, not the half was told. It far exceeds everything I've heard by being in your presence and the thing you're doing. So you have this description of Solomon and what's transpiring with him and his rule and his reign and the judgments he could render. Now, let me pause here for a second. You think about Solomon, what mental image do you get? You know, there's pictures, there's drawings, there's different things. What comes to your mind when you think about Solomon, and especially when you think about his great wisdom? We typically see an individual who's got gray hairs, you know, maybe the gray beard. He sits stately in his position on his throne. He's a person that you look at him and he's aged marvelously well. You know, he's got this kingly appearance. And that's the image. So you think about this. Well, let me note something with you. At the time that Solomon renders this judgment that we're looked at in 1 Kings 3, he was a young man. I mean, he came, he said, I'm a young person. You know, he's early in life, the early 20s, later in that point of time with David, and he comes on the throne. He realizes he's a young person in this period. And so now this is illustrative of the very wisdom that God had given. This was used to demonstrate that wisdom, this one account. Many other judgments he rendered, but this one was demonstrative of what the Lord had provided for him so that he could rule wisely. He was a young individual. He was not this person that was aged. He was not this person that had all this worldly experience that he could draw from. He didn't have this great worldly wisdom, human wisdom, that we might expect somebody to go and say, well, you know, I go to this person because they've lived a good long life. They've had all these different encounters with events of life. They've experienced these things, and I can rely upon them because they've got some insights based on that. Proverbs 20 and 29 talks about the gray hair and the respect that's to be demonstrated to those individuals who've achieved certain things. And we certainly in our time period should respect individuals and that have done certain things and that we can rely upon them. We can go to them for some instructions, some help. We can see that they have some knowledge of God's Word. And they certainly have had things in life that they could relate to help us. Those types of things. 1 Corinthians 1:25 describes how the wisdom of God is, or the foolishness of God is wiser than men. The weakness of God is stronger than men. So even accommodatively referring to God, God's great. You know, you don't rely upon the human wisdom. You don't go to seek out those things that man can offer as being that which is going to be the ultimate understanding of what's right. Circumstance associated with it. So you look at these things. He was a young man. That image that we typically have, certainly Solomon, as he matures, he's going to have those features. As we get to Ecclesiastes, when he looks back upon things of his life, certainly here's an individual who is older. And there's insights that he gleans even from those experiences of life. But that's not what we're talking about in this instance. What we note here is the idea that he had this great wisdom that was given. God provided it. It didn't come from man. Now, disobedience is foolish. And again, I stress the judicial nature of it, because it didn't mean that Solomon was wise in every aspect of his life, right? That wasn't something that we began to see as it involved Solomon. In fact, we see specifically, and as you go to the 28th verse, some things associated with Solomon, some choices that Solomon made. He then went and he married these women, ones that were foreign, ones, alliances. It was not an uncommon thing for an alliance to be formed as a result of through marriage. You know, you marry the daughter of a king of another nation, and so doing so, it kind of helps make alliances. You sort of have that connection. It may on the surface appear to be a pretty clever and appropriate thing to do, and amongst people of the world and during that time frame of what you see going on, that was something that was done rather routinely, or every opportunity that was done. He married a number of these women from other places. But what does God's word say? You don't do that. They have a corrupting influence upon you. You don't marry these foreign. You're as Israelites, you don't go and bring that in. Now, there were those that were converted and then became part of the nation. But we're talking about those outsiders, the heathenistic practices, the idolatry they engaged in. And so you go to the 11th chapter, verse 1 through 6, and as he got older, and as he aged, they began to turn his heart. They influenced him adversely. He first allowed them to do the things that they desired to do in their worshipful activities, and then they drew him into those practices themselves and idolatry. It was a failure on his part. So there's always that warning as well about the idea that somebody being in this situation and circumstances, we need to be careful to follow God's teaching and instruction, because that's where true wisdom is to be found. So he had this great wisdom, the ability to render judgments, but failed in the respect of doing so by following God's word in his own life in this instance. Now, just as a point of reference, we kind of think, and I hope and pray that this is the case, that we think about Ecclesiastes. In the book of Ecclesiastes, being written by Solomon as well, after he looks back and reviews some things of his life, that the penitent disposition and attitude is observable. And to fear God and keep his commandments, that's the whole of man. That concludes those things, and that he saw these things. And so while we see the failure in the historical accounting and what's described there and how his heart had been turned, that Ecclesiastes may be that book that shows a change and doing those things correctly. And we, like I said, that would be something that we certainly are desirous of understanding and being appreciative, and we can always, after failing to follow God correctly, come back to him and repent and humble ourselves in his presence. So those are things, just as a preliminary point associated with the idea of King Solomon. So now let's look at the account. Mother displayed natural affection. That very terminology, natural affection. We'll talk about that expression additionally, but just this natural hate. What do we find with her? She yearned with compassion for her son. That's the New King James. Other translations convey the same type of thing, that it's very deep within her. It's, as we see, a normal emotional response. That this is something that would be expected. It's something that we have within us. It's the feelings that are to be seen because one has this relationship, this connection with them. It's innate in respect to these things. It's a normal thing. That's that of natural affection that's observable. I made a notation just to kind of tie in something here. When you think about 2 Samuel 12, 15 through 23, this is that part of the account with King David. And King David, with the sins he had engaged in, the wrongful conduct, and he went further and further into going into a direction that was wrong and sinful and wicked because of his sin with Bathsheba, the adultery that was committed, that she was with child. We see Nathan confronting him as God had instructed. He recognizes the wrong he had done, and he said, "I've sinned against God." And then that was forgiven, but there were ramifications. There were things that were going to follow because of what he did from a physical standpoint. Sins were forgiven, but there was going to follow some things that would happen, including disruptions in his family, turmoil that would exist, and the problems that we read about from that point with David, and then the death of that child. His and Bathsheba's child. Now, we see, though, that David begins to pray and fast for that child. We see the disposition he has, this yearning similar to what you have with this mother. You know, she yearned when you have Solomon saying, "Bring the sword," because now he's going to, you know, bring the sword. And he says, "We're going to do this fairly. We're going to divide that child, and each will get half." What's her immediate response? Or what's her feeling about that? She had this compassion. She yearned for her son. David prayed earnestly, fervently. He fasted during that time because of that same sense of feeling. This is my son. You know, I care about this child. This child is very precious to me. You know, we can relate to those things, can't we? As parents, as those that family, the ones you take a child in your hand and arms, and you know, just precious, wonderful sense, and you kind of long for it, and it's yours, it belongs to you, this child. And so that yearning, again, it's instinctive, normal, a natural thing. It's something that we should have as a part of our makeup, because God would instill this idea within us. That should be what we would feel. So David, using him illustratively, prayed earnestly. It did not come about as a consequence of things. The sin that he had committed still had the consequences. Then he got up and then cleaned himself, ate. He worshiped the Lord. He continued on recognizing the failure. The child can't come back to us, but we can go to where the child is. That was his explanation to the servants. Normal, natural, appropriate feeling. She yearned for compassion. Here's Solomon. You know, Solomon, thinking about this, this was before you could do certain medical scientific activities, right? Like take some blood and you can at least very, you know, at points in time see the different blood types. Well, you can kind of make some judgments based on that. We've even gone further than that. We've got DNA. You know, you got this information, you take this thing, and now you can really get down to a situation of identifying precisely people that are related and the nature of that relationship. None of those things existed at the time. You didn't have fingerprints. That's, of course, the identifying things or something that you could do. So they just came in, these two women living together, both having children just a few days apart, and the circumstances described. Solomon is brought before him this situation that seems unfathomable to even be able to unravel. Solomon understood human nature because God had given him insights. Solomon, through this judicial ability of having this wisdom to be able to make assessments like this, is why he was able to say, bring that sword, and we're going to divide this child. And the mother instinctively said, because she had this feeling, she's going to respond accordingly. The care, the love, the regard that's observable there. It was sacrificial love, wasn't it? The kind of love that we would anticipate that a parent would have toward a child. A sacrificial love that's going to be observable. One that's willing to give. And even that would be something that would preclude them with certain things. Nonetheless, the child took precedent. Oh, my Lord, give her the living child and by no means kill him. The reaction, the response, can't we relate to that? Can't we understand? I would rather give up this child so the child can live than have the child be put to death. Give it to this woman. I mean, let her have that child. I don't want anything adverse to happen to that child. Is that not something that we understand and we recognize and we comprehend? See, Solomon's just functioning here with some insights to human nature and circumstances involved with that because of God giving him these insightfulnesses, that God gave him this wisdom to make these kinds of judgments. And the thing that you'd have, if something like that had come to us, what would we have done? Go, I don't know, flip a coin? Heads, tails, you know, how am I going to be able to resolve this? It would defy our ability to kind of be able to come up without the technical, scientific, and medical advances we currently have. But for Solomon, he was able to address it. Let me note one other thing before I leave this part of the examination of the account and this mother's natural affection, this yearning within her, and the response that flows naturally from that. Bible love is not just feelings. Now, I understand that obviously emotion is attached to this. Natural affection is that emotion and feelings and this sense that you have, the love and care, and even this idea of the sacrificial love that one's willing to give up something for the betterment of that which they have that love toward and the child that she would have. But we need to also be appreciative when we talk about Bible love that it's not a feeling, an emotion. syrupy sentimentality. That's not the point here when you start looking further, because in Titus 2 and verse 4, among the instructions given for those different categories that comprise a congregation, and he talks about the older men and the older women, the younger men, and there's some things that are told about this as to how the various obligations and how to function properly and what was needful. And the older women were to teach the younger women, and among the things they were to teach them is to love their children. Now, what we're talking about here with that natural affection, do you really have to tell a mother that they need to love this child that they hold in their arms, that they're nursing, that they're caring for, that they look upon them, and the sense of this, that they had carried this child, and the sense of this child now being born and in their arms, and the regard that they have for that child, do you really have to tell them, I'm going to tell you, you need to love that child? In this case, it's not the idea of the natural affection. The love that's being described here is how to demonstrate correctly the training and the things to do with that child, to handle the child. It's the practical matters associated with that natural affection you have so that you raise the child properly and correctly. And that's instruction. That's why the older women can teach the younger women what they need to do in order to demonstrate then how this child is to be taken care of properly and how the child is to be taught rightly. That's that training. That's so that biblical love incorporates that. And that's the reason why I use this illustratively, Matthew 5 and verse 44, how we love our enemies. Not talking about, I have this emotion toward them and I have this just wonderful feeling. This individual, they can treat me so reprehensibly and they've done all these wrongful things to me, but I just have this real close attachment to them. The emotion flows toward them. That's not realistic, is it? God doesn't give us commands that we cannot do. So he's not talking about the emotion. He says, you treat them rightly. You pray for them. You're going to, in spite of how they treat you, you're going to treat them rightly and correctly. You're going to do those things appropriately, and that's the love. It's how you deal with things and what you're going to do toward them and how God expressly sets forth the showing and demonstrating love toward one's enemies that he's got under consideration. And the idea that the mother loving the child, here's how you deal with these things in order from a practical perspective to care for them, see to them, give them the things they need rightly. Because there are a lot of people that may have natural affection, but they have no clue what they need to be doing in order to take care of the one that they have this affection toward rightly and appropriately. So that's biblical love. So natural affection certainly would be a motivation for the biblical love we're going to apply. And this idea of sacrificial love is an element of those things that are observable, but here's how it's going to be accomplishable. Let's turn our attention now to the other woman. Was she devoid of compassion? Well, to say the least. I mean, she says, let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him. That response is one that we know in context of these things. She sees this the situation and circumstance. It's not her child. The natural affection that would be observable is devoid. So it's just not going to be something that is going to be noted. You know, I still must say that it's some elements of that that are a little bit still challenging if you kind of consider human nature and everything. You know, Solomon saw their demeanor. Solomon was already interacting with them. Solomon has some additional insights as far as things are concerned. Because, you know, it's possible that at some point in time that the person goes, is horrified by this. Even though they wanted a child for themselves, they still say, I don't want that child to die. I mean, because, you know, there may be a bit of compassion attached to that. It may be, it's not that natural affection that certainly would be with the mother. But that's not what this woman did. And obviously, Solomon, in that great wisdom, in observing these things, was able to ascertain even more. Not just that the mother, with that natural affection, would be there, but that this other, the woman, and the response would be one that would be very evident and contrary. And so, devoid of anything, not having, emptying herself of any regard for this. And so, you might start thinking, well, what's involved in that? Well, perhaps motivated by envy. Just might be envious. You know, she has something I can't have. I've lost something. And so, you know, if I can't have it, and nobody else can, you know, envy's rottenness to the bone. I mean, the idea of envy and jealousy and how that's such an evil thing that creates all kinds of adverse consequences among people. The one illustration that demonstrates just how reprehensible this idea of jealousy and envy is that what we see with Jesus when he was delivered, why he was delivered, even Pilate knew why. They delivered him for envy because they were envious of his popularity because of things he was doing. It contrasted adversely with their behavior and conduct in life, and so consequently they were envious. So perhaps it was motivated by envy. Certainly we cannot exclude that. It certainly revealed an attitude of selfish cruelty, didn't it? Wasn't that noted? Selfish and the cruelty attached to it. Again, this mentality of all about me, what I want, and I want this, and suddenly it's possible I'm not going to have it, and how is he going to render this judgment? Now he's going to do this thing. Well, I'll just go with that. That sounds good to me, and there's cruelty in this. There's nothing about this child on her part that's worthy or worthwhile. It's all about what I wanted and nothing about that child. Cruelty. You look at James, the third chapter, and just again noting some things that we find that also incorporates some of what we've already made reference to. This idea of those things that are this world, that which is comes from this world and is opposed to wisdom that's from above. You pick up the reading there in verse 14, but if you have bitter envy, self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but it's earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. Certainly that's demonstrated in this context, isn't it? That this kind of disposition and these types of things going on. You remember that Cain murdering his brother Abel? What were the things that behind that? Well, in 1 John 3, verse 12, it describes how, you know, Abel's was, his conduct and behavior was good, contrasted with the evilness of Cain. We find as we go back into the account, you see the unfolding of these things, that disobedience to God as it related to Cain, his countenance fell when he's confronted with this. Abel had done what was right, so he was jealous of his brother having received that which was commending from God, and he himself did it. Instead of changing his life, he struck out against his brother and murdered him, and then tried to, you know, kind of say, well, about the things, well, I don't know where he's at, I don't understand these things, my brother's keeper, all those things that are attached to that, and of course the consequences that followed. There was no natural affection attached to that, was there? It came from this motivation, this idea of selfishness. It's underlying the cruelty that even would lead one to go as far as taking a human life. That's pretty extreme, isn't it? To think about it from that to that extent. To take the life of one that you're related to. The life of one that you have contact and association with, the life that you have here. The person may be somewhat, you know, in a situation where, well, I don't really know the person, I don't, you know, have this connection, etc. So might have those types of things. But in this instance, no, they were related. They were brothers. And you see this. So you find this unfolding and this idea of natural affection. In the New Testament, there are a couple of passages that we note that talks about without natural affection. And it's kind of interesting because as we look at the definitions momentarily, the definition incorporates this. Different translations in the verses kind of render things a little differently. There's still same point is observable. And the King James, the American Standard, are two of the ones that talk about without natural affection when listing these various aspects that are wrong and describes it this way. So you think about those that got further and further away from God and more reprehensible things they did when they forgot God, took him out, got out of their lives. And as God was removed from their life, they more and more got into various conduct and behavior that is reprehensible. And the wrongfulness of it. It's hard to even describe in some situations, even though it's referred to here in Romans 1, having to do with the Gentile world. And you look there at verse 31 in talking about these things. It says, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving. That's the New King James. Unforgiving, unmerciful. Well, that's the same expression that has to do with this idea of unloving. Is without natural affection. You have the same kinds of observations made in the other location where you have that expressed, and the things that talk about even the nature of individuals, those that in latter days, those that display these wrongful conduct, says unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of God. So you can incorporate some of these things, kind of they're described differently, but they can then connect together and see some these things as it involves a person's life, as it intertwines with all these different aspects about it. I like the way that the King James, the American Standard, some of the other translations, say unloving and uncaring or terminology like that. I like without natural affection. I like the way the King James describes that, because it's not just the definition, it's a description. It gives a description. It gives us that sense of what it's all about. Now, there, when you look at the word astrogos, it's that word which translated the uncaring, the unloving, some other terms like that, are the one word, or the phrase, the one word, the phrase of without natural affection as a negative participle, and presumed derivative astergo, to cherish affectionately. So here's that other word, and it's the opposite of it, and cherish affectionately. Well, that's natural affection, isn't it? Hard-hearted towards kindred without natural affection. That comes from Strong's. Just kind of build on this, and it's a similar definition, but I just want to highlight, as you look at this idea of kindred seemingly being an aspect of it, it kind of focuses upon that part of it, though we can kind of take it additionally, but you start from that perspective. Signifies without natural affection. Again, the same Greek word, a negative, and storge, a love of kindred, especially of parents for children, children for parents. Now you go back to that instance, as Vines describes it, you go back to that account where Solomon understood some things, this idea of human nature, and he was able to observe the demeanor of these individuals and how things were going on, and some things that in writing, you kind of read it as this unfolding. Solomon's seeing these individuals and what they're saying and how they're saying it, what they're doing. And so he kind of sees these things. And so here's this idea. You know, a parent toward the child. And then later on, we think the child toward parents, other things, or the kindred, nature of the kindred and the interactions there. And look at Cain toward Abel. You know, instances like this. Well, here's the thing. It's what one would expect, what one would recognize, and it's observable there. But this word is without those things being evident, without that being part of one's life. It's removed, and so consequently, look at all the things that transpire as a result of that. So what's the application? Very likely to end up in the similar predicament standing before someone like King Solomon who has to render a judgment. I sympathize with judges in our society. Of course, you have these laws, you have all these different things, circumstances surrounding it, and you have to abide by certain stuff. But some of the cases that come before judges can be very hard, very difficult, and those that even are involved in various aspects of it, and those that then are placed in our governance, as we have our judicial system, you get these individuals, and the part of our Constitution provides that we are then able to have a jury of our peers to be able to look at the evidence laid out. And you see these things, some terrible, difficult types of things that are brought before, and the judges making these renderings, or people having to look at these various things that are brought before, the kinds of things that we see in society that sometimes we see on TV, we read about and everything. Now kind of all of a sudden, here it is, and now you're going to go through this process. It's a heart-rending kind of things that sometimes comes to the fore when having to deal with various matters. Well, making these kinds of judgments, you know. We're not too apt to have similarly things, but in our society, there's a lot of things about this aspect without natural affection that certainly exist. And I submit to you that it starts with the idea as it relates to the family, and then it is used kind of as part of the family, and then it goes out into the society as a whole, and it kind of impacts society as a whole. Because you'll see how these things are taking place. And some of the things that we think about as it relates to this, that things lacking in our society when it comes to natural affection, abortion. The idea of abortion, the murdering of a child in the womb. You know, you kind of start looking at these types of things and go, you know, murder, and I use that term because that's the correct biblical expression. Now, I mentioned about King James and how without natural affection, as opposed to just uncaring or unloving or some other ways to define it, that I prefer that because, again, it's descriptive. Well, the King James also says kill, thou shalt not kill. Well, that's not able to really convey correctly as we think about it and understand. There's all kinds of killing that goes on, and some of it God himself sanctioned, authorized, and even demanded, taking of human life. Murder, though, is taking of innocent human life. And so the translations that talk about thou shalt not murder correctly conveys the idea. The innocent human life that we see. And you think about the human life in the womb. You know, people have attempted, and you have to go about this in many instances because there is that aspect of natural affection and it can impact how things are seen or observable. So you dehumanize. You kind of take that part of the equation out so people can kind of have a sense that, you know, there's not really a problem and it relates to these things. So that's a fetus instead of a living child that's developing in the womb. You use terminology that sort of causes people to remove themselves from the terminology that helps them understand what's transpiring in actuality. And so you see this thing and this that's going on. I noted here a passage found over in Isaiah 49:15, and it's used there as instructive of some things that are being set forth to talk about God toward his people. But the illustration helps us also observe something about it. You don't use the illustration to help convey something. So here, can a woman forget her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? Surely they may forget, yet I will not forget you. That's God's referencing, and he uses illustratively of that mother toward her child that has that natural affection. He's talking about his regard for them. But he uses the son in the womb. This idea, you know, we can talk about all kinds of things that help us be appreciative of the idea that that's a living being that's developing. And you can go look at all these things. There's an interesting thing that happens in the states and where, of course, in our society and the reprehensible aspect of this being legalized, abortion rampant amongst us and people going about and having availability of the taking and, again, sanctioned by the governance to permit this, as opposed to the idea that that's something that the government realizes we need to protect the innocent. But it goes on, you have these things happen. But some states going around, and they try to limit at least the availability or some things associated with people thinking more understandably about what's going on. And so there have been those laws that have been passed in some of the states that say, you know, before you can have abortion, you're going to have a sonogram, and you're going to have to look at the sonogram. What do you see when you see the sonogram? See a child in the womb, moving, development, you see all the things. And those that are wanting to keep abortion and even encourage abortion, and sad to say, there are those who actually promote it. They think the more abortions there are, the greater and one more wonderful it is, dehumanizing and getting further and further away from God. They fight those kinds of laws. Why do they fight the kinds of laws? Because they understand if people start seeing, if the mother starts seeing that child, they're going to have this sense, that child that's within me. And instead of going through with an abortion, many of them might say, you know, I can't do that. There's other alternatives that are preferable. And Amos 1, verse 13, as Amos is going through all these different nations and some of the behaviors they did that was condemned, among those things was Ammon, and they were being condemned as a result of the fact that they ripped open the mothers with children that were in the womb, recognizing that that child, a living child, circumstances. You can go back and look at all the motivations and sometimes circumstances of people going. Selfishness is a major motivation for people. I don't want to take care of this child. They've done these things. I don't want to have any involvement, etc. There's all these. There are alternatives to even that. Even the mentality that, well, if I'm in a position, I did wrong and I sinned, but I have this child. You know, there are people that want children, and you know, I can give that child up. Yearning with compassion and the willingness, at sacrificially, I can't take care of this child. I'm willing to give that child up so somebody else can see to that child who I love, who I have compassion for, yearning compassion, sacrificial love. There are alternatives to these things. Our society gets further and further away from God by these behaviors and conduct. And it starts again with people's personal dispositions and things what ought to be natural are being removed from that scene. Euthanasia, eugenics. The terminology here, it's murdering the aged and unwanted. Again, I use the terminology that we find and incorporate this concept about this. Eugenics is kind of an interesting term. Euthanasia, of course, is the idea of somebody older. It's assisted suicide, usually associated with that. Assisted suicide comes into play. They have various instances and reasoning behind it. You can incorporate that. But they become a part of society that's no longer a useful part of society. Or you get to that point in time. And again, it dehumanizes. You devalue life made in the image of God. So you start seeing these things. And I would point out there's a distinction between the end of life care and this idea of hastening life that still has the viability in other situations, simply because we feel that they are not something in this society that is worthwhile. Totally different mentality, all right? So you see these kinds of things. In Matthew 15, 3 through 6, this takes this other end of that equation. We're talking about the family and the idea of the word itself, kind of first of all confined in the concept of family, family relationships, the mother toward the child toward the parents. You have also the idea that it can be, again, expanded among family circumstances. But so here you have this situation during that day when Jesus rebuked those leaders and teachers because they had taken their traditions and elevated them above God, God's laws. And so even while they criticized certain of their traditions that people weren't following, Jesus pointed out, y'all aren't following the commandments of God. You've taken and set those aside and supplanted your own traditions. And the one he used had to do with the idea, you're to honor father and mother. Honor father and mother as part of what's required is to see to them. You take care of them when they're not able to take care of themselves. And you said that that's not all an obligation of taking money and caring for them out of my pocket and seeing to them when I'm giving, making a gift to the temple. See, so I'm exempted from that. Well, what's the underlying problem? Here's the situation where we are to see to, take care of, and provide. And there ought to be a natural affection, a natural regard, a caring, and this aspect about that, because here's family, here's those ones, and I need to demonstrate that. Eugenics, get back to this thing for a moment. Eugenics, in a sense, you kind of throw out society. This is not something unique to our society as far as some aspects of this is concerned, because you go back in history and you read about some very reprehensible things that were done, various societies, and they were based on certain ideas and concepts, and where at the birth of a child, the child would be unwanted for whatever reasons, and they weren't up to what they determined, they disposed of it. You have societies that when people get to a certain point, they cannot contribute to society, that they are removed and they're sent away, they die, put to death. You have these things. I could list some of them. It's irrelevant just from a perspective of having to cite those. It happens, and one can go back and read it, and it's disturbing to think about this. But then we think, well, those societies, look how evil they were. And then we start looking at our society, and you start seeing how this thing is brought in different ways. evidenced in somewhat varying fashions, but people that go through this. Eugenics is this idea. It actually was a word that's coined, even though some of the practices preceded it. You know, it's like other things, words get along. It's the idea that you want to make things theoretically better, and so the genetics of things, so you put things together so that you get a better person that comes out of this. By better, in their mind, that is better specimen. You know, they have these features, they have these things. They're more acceptable in all these ways. Now, so you kind of have that. Well, then what if you don't have that, then that's unacceptable, so we need to dispose and get rid of. There's the individual who coined it, and the time period in which this was discussed and described came about during the period with Darwin, Charles Darwin, and the survival of the fittest. He kind of came up with some of these things, and some of these individuals incorporated those thoughts and ideas and then started applying it. Hitler practiced that. He's not the only one, but he's one that comes readily to our minds, and we think about what was he doing. He's getting rid of the undesirables. Those did not be his criteria. The superior race of the German people, which he was advocating, see, that's the concept of eugenics. Things associated with man who sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Murder, Genesis 9:6. The idea that this was to be something that murder and taking of life. Life is precious because we're made in God's image. That's what makes life precious. Man's arrogance and presumptuousness to suggest that he's going to have a better understanding, and the idea of compassion, and those that are the most vulnerable in our society, by showing and demonstrating this, shows a compassion and regard and a care that the family has toward one another, and then throughout society. This is something that is to be demonstrated. It's to be observable. It's precious. It makes things where we see what is going to then translate into the idea of how we treat each other, caring for one another. In Deuteronomy 18 and verse 10, just as you read through this, there's warnings about certain things, including causing your children to pass through the fire, you make a sacrifice of them. You have those types of situations that are described. I want to look at one last verse about this idea of compassion and the nature of compassion. As it relates then to seeing people around us, you know, there are biblical principles about how we're to do things and treat others, and there's regard, but that natural affection that again transcends even just among family, but if it's not present in family, you know, then how is it going to be evidenced in the society as a whole? And if you can undermine that, what's it going to do? And this idea that in Romans 1, where you get further and further away from God, the more reprehensible things that you observe in society that's taking place. What you find here is an instance with Jesus, and of course with the compassion of Jesus, in verse 40 of Mark chapter 1. Now a leper came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him, saying to him, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Then Jesus, moved with compassion, stretched out his hand, touched him, and said to him, "I'm willing, be cleansed." And as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. Of course, this idea of compassion, the yearning within. So we see individuals that we can help legitimately. We see those that are vulnerable that we can care for. We see those that around us that deserve our regard, the yearnings that we have, that we are going to show these and demonstrate it. And let me say, as we close then, and go through all kinds of additional things and kind of develop this further. But as we think about this idea, and we consider it in the compassion of our Lord, what was his first and foremost concern for us is our spiritual well-being, so we can make heaven our eternal abode. He came and died upon the cross for us. And while he showed compassion for the physically ones that had difficulties, and he healed individuals to demonstrate compassion, and also that he's the Son of God, the principal thing he did for us is to give us the opportunity to make heaven our home eternally. We can have our sins forgiven. And if we stand in need of that, he's made these provisions. He's given us his word. He's given us direction to tell us how that we can live rightly in his sight so that one day we can hear, "Well done, thy good and faithful servant." If you're subject to his call, either be baptized for remission of your sins or the need to correct something amiss in your life. We looked at this idea that associated with making changes like David, I've sinned against God. Any way that you're subject to his call, won't you please come forward, make your request known as together we stand and sing.